This conversation with the Irish novelist Edna O'Brien was recorded in May 2011. I'm Christopher Lydon with the Irish writer Edna O'Brien. Exiled these many years to London and New York and the mad embrace of the whole world of English prose. In her new book of heart-scalding stories, if I may say, it's called Saints and Sinners, Edna O'Brien personifies for me the gift of writing and the pleasures of reading for the eye, for the ear, for your soul, in the dark of night or the light of day. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. This one with that scandalous woman. In one of her book titles almost 40 years ago, Scandalous Woman was Edna O'Brien's reputation as a writer for the novels and stories, starting with Country Girls, that told the rueful fate of women in love and life, and not just in the rural west of Ireland, where Edna O'Brien grew up. The scandal today is just that your new stories, Edna O'Brien, have all the power of your old ones and of the best stories you could ever read by Joyce or Chekhov or Alice Munro or anybody else. I would so love, Edna O'Brien, for you to read from the first story in this book. It's called Shovel Kings, meaning Irish men who came and labored in London, digging the blue clay of London for most of the years that you have lived there, since the mid-50s. The man known as Rafferty is under a permanent frost, you say, and he's got a heart immeasurably broken. There's a passage in the middle where he's talking about a bad time, and he sees a woman that he's known years earlier. And I'd just love you to read that section.
Page 22, yes. One morning, Rafferty continued, I crawled out from under a quilt to go and get a fix. Usually a few people were in the streets going to work or coming from night work, and they'd give you something, especially the women. The women had softer hearts. On the other side of the street, I saw a woman in a belted white raincoat looking across at me. It was Madge, who had married Billy from the old days. She came over, and I can still see her thinking it, but not saying it. You should see yourself, Rafferty. Your dignity gone, your teeth half gone, your beautiful black hair gone grey, and your eyes glazed. I said, how's Billy? And she said, Billy's dead and gone. And her eyes filled up with tears. I could hardly believe it. Accordion Bill that had been such a swank. The two of them such swanks on the dance floor, winning medals and drinking rosé wine. Billy had left the building work after they got the franchise of a pub over in St. Martin's Lane, which, as she said, was the ruination of him and of them. Then all of a sudden, she pulled a little notepad from her pocket and thrust it into my hand. This was the chance encounter he believed she had been waiting for, to meet someone from the old days so that she could show it. Her history jotted down at different times, often a scrawl, and with several coloured inks was in it. Badly beaten up again, internal bleeding, rushed to hospital and nearly lost the baby. Billy, not home for 3 days and three nights, searched up and down the high street, found him in an allotment with other blokes, drinking cheap cider, didn't even recognise me, brought him home, cleaned him up, washed him, shaved him, promised to get him new clothes when I got my pay packet. He wept in my arms half the night, and I plucked up the courage, and I asked him, why did he drink like that? And his answer was, to blank things. I said, what things? He said something had happened, that's all he'd say. Something happened. Took her to his grave, he did. I handed the note back to her, and she said, I still love him. Will you tell me why I still love him, Rafferty? I couldn't. As she ran to catch the bus, she turned back and shouted, no one is given a life just to throw it away. It done something to me. I set myself a goal, 1 pint in the morning and 2 pints at night, and not a drop more ever, except maybe for a toast at a wedding.
Is there any other people that has a whole literature of drink? What is it about the Irish and drinking?
I think it's very much to do, oddly enough, I'm not apologising for it, liking a drink myself as I do. I think it's very much to do with imagination. Particular kind of very fevered and, if you like, heightened imagination, which drink helps or seems to help while it's happening. And it's to do with a loneliness that imaginative people have, I believe. I may be wrong, but I'm not sure that I'm wrong. I think people who live in through the imagination and through language, and if you know from reading diaries and letters of people, writers much more, for instance, than painters are more given to drink because it's not physical. It's not a physical activity. It's a lonely activity in the mind. And to tie that up with Ireland and Irish people, many Irish people, even when the old Celtic tiger raised its wicked tail, are would-be writers. They're not necessarily have the discipline to sit and write and to dedicate a life to it, which is what you have to do. But they are would-be writers. And drink is somehow a fillip to that. It's, of course, it's a hindrance if it goes too far. But it's the temperament of the people, and the way the Irish drink is different to the way the English drink. Now, the English drink a lot, and in fact, at football matches in Europe and all that, the English drinkers are the ones, you know, the fans are the ones who make the most trouble. But the Irish connect drink very much with song, with revelry, and with no tomorrow. Unfortunately, there is a tomorrow with no song the next day. And it's to do with a desperation as well. Desperation, very talented people are often very desperate. And a lot of Irish people that I know, even though they might be failures, are also very talented. It seems like an excuse, but I hope it isn't.
Rafferty, in your story, is a labourer, not a writer that we know of, although he tells a wonderful story, but he came to London at the age of 15 or 16 and was worked to death virtually from the first day.
Yes.
I think he drank out of exhaustion, and there was a social as well as an imaginative problem in his life.
Well, the first time he ever went, the allure of the pub, the red lamps, you know, they always look very alluring from outside, the red lamps and curtains, and then you look in and there's a sort of whiff of excitement and people talking, and I think it became, as it did for many Irish people and for labourers, it became home. It was the home that they would never have again, because it was friendly. You could sit alone and have the first pint and then mingle, and they knew each other, and the warmth of it, along with the warmth of the drink. So that was what started him on the slippery slope. And as an aside, I'd like to tell you this little story. Shovel Kings, the one you have selected this story for me to talk about, took me 4 or 5 months to write. And it was inspired by my son Sasha, my great shepherd. He said he was in a pub one St. Patrick's Day in North London where he had to go and, I don't know, get a mirror or something. And there was he was with a girlfriend. There was a man reading a paper beside them. And the man put the paper down, and the girl thought that the paper belonged to the pub. So she looked it up to read her horoscope, probably. And she was reading it, and then she put the paper down. And then a crowd started to come in. And the man got up and he said to the girl with utter courtesy, "Do you mind if I take my paper back?" And she was mortified. And they offered him a drink. He said no. So Sasha told me just that story. That was the seed. And as a result of that, he said, "You could write a good story about those people." And always when you write something, the external subject has to have a resonance internally. I feel in many ways a failure as well as feeling that I've done something. So I thought, I'm going to search out these people through hostels and various places in North London where they get free dinner every day and having a pint or two. So I was very lucky. I met about, I can't say interviewed because I'm not really trained to be interviewing. But I met 20 or 25, 30 of them, different ones. Mm. I went to different places, different venues, and always, this seems to be only about drink, this conversation. It was always in a pub. And I had to time it that I would get there to that pub around 5:30 or 5:45, because by 8:30, the old memory wouldn't be quite as fresh. And they weren't at all suspicious. They weren't in the least suspicious. I said, I want to write a story. Can you tell me some of your experiences? Mm. And a lot of what they told me was codology. But just being with them, it was in some ways the easiest story I ever wrote, because I just had this access to these people. But then I had to write it. And I thought, how would it be if a person, the narrator, never mentions her own pain? And she finds, she goes in to get the look at the clock in this pub, as you know, and sees this man who is rather distant with her. And as she says, he looked like a man on whom a permanent frost had fallen. And then, by chance, one day, in that same part of London, in the story, this didn't happen in life, she's walking down a street, Kilburn High Street, a lot of Irish people, a fairly working street, and there's a second-hand shop, awful furniture, all cushions and all lamps, a chair you couldn't sit on. And there on an armchair is the hero Rafferty. And it's as if he's presiding. And he sings a few bars of I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, in the story. And because she has seen him, and this happens with in Russian stories as well, I love the Russians, because they have met, if you like, out of context, away from the pub where every time she goes for her appointment, she gets there early and sees him. They've met, it's only a mile away, but it's in a different area and it's out of doors and there's birds, a few birds in the sky, and it's sort of the light of evening. And he starts to tell her his story. And once I've found that device, if I can use that word, I was very happy writing it.
I'd like to ask you about another story, the last story in the book called Old Wounds. I mean, drink is nothing in terms of the Irish problem compared to the past and to a kind of resentment. That old line about Irish Alzheimer's, all you remember is the grudges and this kind of thing. But Old Wounds is about a divided family and an attempt at reconciliation. A man who had married a woman and then thrown his mother out of the ancestral home and embittered a great many people, including himself, is trying to make amends with the writer.
A cousin, yes.
A cousin. And the writer says there had been so many differences between the two families over greyhounds, over horses, over some rotten bag of seed potatoes, and always with money at the root of it. But she also remembers, and this sounds like my family too in some strange way, she remembers her grandmother saying that the knowledge of eviction and the fear of the poorhouse ran in our blood.
Blood. Well, that is true. I feel that, even though I'm reckless and extravagant with money and never have money, and yet the fear is there. I remember my grandmother, my mother's mother. I had two different types of parents. I had the O'Briens that were profligate and the Clearys that were thrifty.
I had Clearys in my family.
You did? Oh, yeah. Well, we'd be related.
I hope.
And that fear and shame of hunger and famine, because there were people, I was born in 1930, and there were people who knew someone who had been in the time of the famine, you know, some of their family. Mm. And there was one story I'll never forget that someone told me. And it wasn't just his own relatives. It was true for many. Rather than be seen to die by walking, you know, to where they might get, because they gave them blood to drink. Bullock's blood was given. You'd walk to this workhouse to keep alive. They would shut the door and die inside, not be seen. So it's not only the pain of dying of hunger, but the shame of dying. And that sense of, it has a curious pride to it, it has a hopeless pride to it, but also that sense of literally having nothing. And I think it does run in one's blood. It doesn't alter one's character, I'd like to emphasize, but it's there. And my theory, why Celtic Tiger and why some of the Irish, the lucky or the predatory ones, I should say, rather than the lucky ones, why they flew so high and so recklessly and borrowing millions, was that instinct, that very thing that we've touched on, the fear and the residue of poverty that had been always their heritage, not only subordination, but also poverty. And suddenly money, this finding of money, it is like crocks of gold, except it wasn't crocks of gold. It was money that they bled out of the country of Ireland and from their own people. That is true. And it's a very terrible and unforgivable tragedy.
There's one wonderful story in this book, Green Georgette, which sounds to me like Edna O'Brien as a young girl observing class pretensions and snobbishness and resentment in one little town, especially between the writer's mother and the banker's wife who's just arrived and is putting on the dog and whatnot. As I read that, I wondered, isn't this the behavior of people in captivity in a certain way, in the still worshipping a British model? They refer to the banker's wife as the queen, but there's this sense of almost prisoners of a British-made system squabbling over rank. Does that make any sense?
Well, it makes 50% sense.
Good. That's enough.
It's the lesser person, like the narrator and her mother, are farmers.
Yes.
Farming. They're country people. They're ignorant. They make soda bread rather than shop bread and so on. And this woman, this toff, who comes into the town, who is a complete phony, is, in a sense, you're right in that she would love to be an English lady. Mm-hmm. As it happens, she's a jumped-up Irish woman purporting to be something else. And the little girl, the narrator, she doesn't even know, I think. And I wrote these stories. When I write stories, you become the character, the voice of the character you're writing about. She sees everything in a child's eyes, as you say. But what it does is the shame she feels. Her mother trying to condescend and smarmy to this fake woman, you know, who gives them shop cake and a sandwich with nothing in it, and then has a rendezvous with a doctor in the middle of it, leaves them there. And the little girl sees everything, the woman's shoes, the silver, the filigree on the woman's shoes, the gauze of the scarf, the green georgette. And it's all like, you know, Daisy in Great Gatsby. Not that she would know Daisy, but it's all so magical and glamorous. Mm. And yet there's this ugliness within it. And as you know, the end of the story, which I find quite hilarious, she's walking home. Her mother and her have failed to, you know, be a hit in this house and won't be asked again. And there's dew on the grass and there's cows wheezing as they do when they sit at night in grass, the cows munching and wheezing. And the mother says, well, I can always say I've met the great Mrs. Corcoran. And the little girl says something like, suddenly I had this craving for tinned peaches, but Mama said it would be extravagant to open them at that hour of night, but she would one day soon and have them with a souffle from which she had just mastered the recipe for. I looked up at our own house and the kitchen window was dark, which meant my father had gone to bed and would want a cup of tea brought up or there would be eructions on the morrow. And then she has this triple murderous longing. She wants to that the bullocks will rise up and mount each other, that her school will go on fire, that her father will die in his sleep, and that Mr. Corcoran, the husband where we were, will take a pistol to his wife before shooting himself. It's hilarious, but it's so vengeant.
It's a bright little girl and a beginning of a great writer who's seeing all this, I think. It reminded me, though, even as you speak, of an expression my mother used to use, sort of an Irish expression, I think, of the phenomenon of looking down from below at people. In other words, they look down on the people who use shop cookies and shop cake.
Yeah.
Even though they were lower on the pecking order.
Yes. Well, that's human nature. But it's particularly evident. See, I feel very lucky that I came from a small and indeed very often bigoted community, because I was given an opportunity to see a lot of things, to overhear things, to hear things, to look into people's lives. And I still, strangely enough, have that opportunity. They've forgiven me my sins as such. But I also, when I go home to Ireland, I was full of stories still. I don't get any stories in London. I get them in Ireland. And I'll tell you a minor joke. I was invited by the president, who was a friend of mine, Mary McAleese, and a lovely woman, to attend the lunch for the Queen. And I go to Ireland, and I get them, sent the invitation, of course, like, and the map, and where you have to go. You have to go through such and such a gate and find a house. The name of a house was given, or address, I think it was. So I have the invitation. I get a taxi, a Dublin taxi driver, raving away with erroneous facts about the length and breadth of the park and Royal, I mean, just talking codology nonstop. And we get to the gate. So there's a guard there in his uniform. And the taxi driver says to the guard, I'm bringing this woman, Miss O'Brien, to the lunch. This is her invitation. Where's our dress house? The guard says, I haven't a clue. I'm up from the country for the day. No, you wouldn't get that in London. There's this, you know, real touch still of comedy. But in Ireland, as I said, I am lucky in that I can still find a story or two. They're getting less, but they're still there.
Oh, you're so modest. You're one of the great writers, but you're also one of the great listeners. And you extract. I think you have a secret, and I wish you'd tell me. What? You are a great interviewer, Edna O'Brien. Extraordinary. No. What is it?
Well, I don't think I am, to tell you the truth. I am curious about people. That's why I don't like social life so much, because social life, people put on masks. It's hypocrisy.
Sure.
Whereas a real conversation, you know, like used to happen in Russian fiction in trains, a man would meet a person in a train or a woman,
yes,
and they would talk and tell. I like to hear about people's lives, not just because I want to write about it, which is also, have to be confessed, but because, well, it's lonely on earth, really. Mm. And two things make it less lonely. One is literature, which we have to try and save in this wicked and worried and crazy world. And the other is meeting or talking with someone who actually, even for an hour, kind of enchants you. I don't even mind if people tell me total lies, so long as, you know, there is that connectedness with the imagination and with the heart and with what's deepest in people. And you don't get that much. You get this regularized language. Everything is so uniform. The individuality is getting lost.
There's something about you also that both says no nonsense here. Let's talk about real things. And also says you can talk with impunity. You're not going to suffer for this.
Yes, well, I think that's essential, isn't it? Yeah, I don't want script. What comes out. And I think what you might be saying in some form or other, I'm not cautious. I'm not a cautious person. That's a good thing and it's a not good thing. And writing, you see, you said something that I was modest or so. It's not so much that I'm modest, but you're alone writing all the time. And you don't have a coterie around you. And you don't have people puffing you up with praise. I was in an airplane yesterday for about an hour and a half, apart from being 4 hours waiting. And there was a magazine there, and there was an interview. There's an interview with a rapper, Jay-Z. A long interview, very long, several pages. And I was astonished by the arrogance in it. and the sense of being Lord of the Ring. I'm sure he's a gifted man, but I felt there was nothing in it compassionate or human or actually creative. And I was surprised. Because people who are famous, they have a lot of money. Money is very central to fame. It usedn't to be, but it is. And B, they have an entourage. And that makes them talk in scripts. It's a script. And the script varies a little, but the script is always about how great I am. A writer, if he or she are lucky, I'd like the money, but that's not going to happen, doesn't have an entourage. A writer writes and lives alone. And that makes for a certain degree of unhingedness, if I may use a very posh word, but also a sense of you can't be talking codology. You have to be truthful.
Codology. That's an Irish word we have to learn.
Yes, well, it means rubbish, you know. Foolish, thoughtless talk.
Tell us about the post-Celtic Tiger Ireland that President Obama is seeing for the first time. How's it doing? Not that you were ever fooled by the illusion of suddenly we're rich, but how is it taking the sort of return to reality?
Oh, very bad. President Obama would not see that. How could he in a 24-hour visit? And they were so excited about his coming that, I mean, money could be dug up out of the earth to put on a good show. Mm. And the little village Moneygall, with its population of, it's either 360 or 240, I forget, but it's not huge. Well, you know, everything, the streets were paved, were painted, bunting and flags out. What he would have seen was a genuine, overexcited welcome, that's for sure. I mean, they were delirious with excitement, and it meant so much to. But in terms of the actual situation, when President Obama took off in the plane for London the following day, the situation is harrowing and it's bleak, and it's very, very painful to see. I was in Dublin just last week, as I said. And streets, in quite grandish streets, where there were, you know, like boutiques or shops where you'd have so many closed. And as passing down a side street, and there was a shop that I had known quite well from the steps that led up to it. Mm. Grass and weeds are growing out of the steps. Mm. And I thought, if I were a painter, I'd paint that. You know, the ritzy bit, there was still a sign up there that it had been something. Mm. Now, that's a very, just one instance. Far more so, there's a human story in every single place. And at the same time, the moguls and the people who caused this and who created it, bankers, developers, builders, and to a great extent, barristers, all the collusion, they're pretty well off. They still have a few motor cars. They may have had to surrender their helicopters, but they're not on the red line.
They've substantially stuck the people with the bill. I mean, it's not so different from the States, but it's a more exaggerated case of the party's over and you've got the debt.
Exactly. Exactly. But what is ironic and unfortunate, Ireland for 700 or 800 years, I get the dates wrong almost, the enemy was from beyond the sea. The enemy was the conqueror, England, Great Britain. Ireland, in a matter of 10 years, has managed to do such harm to her own. Mm. You can't blame the outsider this time. Ireland did it to her own people. Mm. And that's even a bitterer.
Of course, they threw the government out. Will there be any redress, do you think?
People say, I'm not a economist, but that it will be half a century before Ireland gets back on its. That's what's said. Now, that could be exaggeration, but it might not be exaggeration. So there is a sinking feeling. And there's also, people rally, there's a bit of humour. But deep down, there's this shock and shame. It was let down by the Catholic Church, and let down by their own money men, God and Mammon both.
Mm. The Irish live in a screen culture, we know that, and yet the word hasn't died. We had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a most extraordinary young Nigerian-American writer. His name is Teju Cole, and his first novel, celebrated everywhere, is called Open City. But he's extraordinarily well-read, well-educated, 35 years old. But he was talking about his examples, his goals, and without the slightest immodesty, he was not shy either. And he said, one of these days, he has to tackle, or the world has to tackle, what he called the unexploded ordnance of Ulysses and Joyce. Mm-hmm. He's formed by the Portrait of the Artist and the Dubliner's stories, but he said right out, I mean, how long can we pretend that we can write 19th century novels forever and ever after Joyce's Ulysses? I wonder what you make of that, and who is up to the task of...
No one. No one's up to it. No, we can't pretend. T.S. Eliot, when he read Ulysses, said he wished, for his own sake, he had never read it, and that it was 18 different styles, which it is, in the 18 chapters of Ulysses. Ulysses is a mountain. It's a literary mountain or a galaxy or whatever other words. And what Joyce did, and what killed him in the end, because I'm sure he went mad, Finnegan's Wake, you know, spent 17 years on Finnegan's Wake, which is incomprehensible, it truly is, that the labor of Ulysses, I wrote a book about Joyce, a brief biography, of which I am very proud. I love Joyce, and I even think he would like it. And I went through it chapter by chapter by chapter. And the journey and the daring and the audacity and the genius and the experiment and the humanity as well that Joyce charted through that book is 18 novels in one. And people are afraid. Often people say to me, oh, I can't read Ulysses because it's too daunting or it's too difficult. And I said, you know what you should do? Is not open it at page one. Just take a chapter and read it, and you get carried away. But you see, we come back to another trend in present-day life, and it's this. People are rather lazy. They like accessible books now. They like prose that isn't too... I mean, if poor William Faulkner, who is also a great hero of mine, was writing Light in August or Sound and the Fury today, would sell 3,000 copies because they want something simple. They want house wine in literature, whereas Joyce is not house wine.
No. How do you, Edna O'Brien, compromise with house wine taste?
Well, I try not to compromise. I'm doing my best, whatever that might be. I work over the words. The words have to be absolutely the right and only words for that material. And I love language. I love words. I love the music of words. But what is essential as well is the feeling and depth within those words. And I'm, as I said in my book on Joyce, I said we're all just in the outer ring of that constellation called James Joyce. We keep going.
We can't talk about all the stories, but there are two others. I just love a comment. One, The Two Mothers, in which you go back to themes you've written so beautifully about before, about your own mother. It didn't seem fiction at all. And then another story called Plunder, about war. And I read it, and all I could think about was Libya and Iraq
and Sudan,
Syria,
and Somalia,
anywhere,
and all those places in Africa. You see these young women on the television, two or three, or maybe alone, something carrying something on their heads, a bundle. And where are they walking to? And they've been raped physically, raped psychologically. And I look at it and I feel so ashamed and so helpless and so angry. So angry. And I mean, you brought something into my mind that's worth for a moment talking about. And I even thought this morning, not that I was writing, a bit unslept and a bit jet-lagged, but I looked at the picture of the devastation.
In Missouri, yes.
In Missouri. And I thought, I can't write that story. I couldn't write that story. I'm not there. And therefore, is it an indulgence to sit down and write something, another story, or write, or want to write? And I veer, as I'm sure many serious people do, between the obsession and the determination and the appetite, and the relish, and the everything else to keep writing, and reading, of course, which is essential to writing, reading great books. I veer between that and the sense of how tiny, how marginal, how unimportant it is, set against the backdrop of the world we live in. The world probably as it always was in some country or another, but now we see it. It's on the news every night. The world, the world, the world.
Plunder is a shocking story, all the more for being so out of your line, but it's the world that's shocking, and I admire that.
It's the last story I wrote in the collection. It was hell to write. It was hell to write. I was trying to take an abstract place and give it moments of palpability, like eating an apple or a cow that hadn't been milked for days and the milk bleeding out of the teeth, dripping out of the teeth. I was trying to place it and yet make it a place and a placelessness. And I nearly went loopy writing it. It's only 3 pages long.
Very striking. Edna O'Brien, thank you so much for these stories, for a lifetime of work that we admire and enjoy and reread. And thank you so much for taking this time with me and with Open Source. We love your work and we won't forget any of this.
Oh, thank you. I am so happy to be here. I haven't been with you now for some years, 5 or 6 or maybe 7. And when I saw that I was invited back, I was thrilled. It's like being asked to the dance again after some years. Thank you very, very much.
What
thank
a
you
charmer
both.
You are. Thank you, Edna O'Brien. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. Special thanks to Monica Higgins at the Boston Athenaeum for giving us a studio in their venerable stacks. The conversation isn't complete until listeners like you feed back with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leibman. Thank you for being part of the conversation.